There's a famous episode when Douglas comes to the White House after Lincoln's second inaugural, and he's denied admission. And Lincoln hears about this and immediately orders the guards to let Douglas in. And there's a long line of visitors waiting to shake his hand. And he sees Douglas come in and he says, "Hey, Douglas, there's Douglas, my friend Douglas. There's no man whose opinion I value more and I'm more eager to hear. Douglas, come here." And then Douglas says, "Well, Mr. President, you had all these people in line. I don't want to jump the line." And no, the president, "No, there's no man whose opinion I'm more eager to hear than you." And then Douglas time and again later says that Lincoln treated him with the utmost respect, didn't always agree with him, but you could sense that he was a racial egalitarian, that he hated slavery deeply and profoundly.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In a little-known eulogy given shortly after Abraham Lincoln's assassination, Frederick Douglass called the martyred president emphatically the black man's president, and the first to show any respect for their rights as men. To justify this description, Douglass pointed not just to Lincoln's official acts and utterances like the Emancipation Proclamation or the second inaugural address, but also to the president's own personal experiences with black people. Referring to one of his White House visits, Douglass said, "In daring to invite a Negro to an audience at the White House, Mr. Lincoln was saying to the country, 'I am president of the black people as well as the white, and I mean to respect their rights and feelings as men and as citizens.'" But Lincoln's description as the black man's president rests more on his relationship with Douglass or on his official words and deeds. Lincoln interacted with many other black Americans during his presidency. His willingness to meet with them in the White House, to honor their request, to invite them to consult on public policy, to treat them with respect, whether they were kitchen servants or abolitionist leaders, to invite them to attend receptions, to sing and pray with them in their neighborhoods, these were all manifestations of what Frederick Douglass called an egalitarian spirit, which was also noted by other prominent African-Americans like Sojourner Truth, who said, "I never was treated by anyone with more kindness and cordiality than were shown to me by that great and good man, Abraham Lincoln." To discuss this issue is today's guest, Michael Burlingame. He's the author of the book, The Black Man's President, Abraham Lincoln, African-Americans, and the Pursuit of Racial Equality. We focus on Lincoln's personal interchange with black Americans over the course of his career, which reveals the side of the president that until now hasn't been completely explored. We had Michael on earlier to talk about the very stormy and troubled relationship that Abraham had with Mary Todd, and this is another element of his life that is definitely worth looking into. So hope you enjoy this discussion with Michael Burlingame. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We had a great discussion last time about the marriage between Abraham and Mary, and she contributed to Abraham's greatness and his character and what carried him through the Civil War, not so much for her positive or her negative qualities, which is a very interesting, important chapter to touch on. But equally, if not much more important, is Lincoln's relationship with black Americans, something that's under significant contemporary discussion. So before we get into the particulars of Lincoln's story in this matter, when you speak with different audiences, whether they're lay audiences or academic audiences, what do you think surprises people the most when they learn about Lincoln's relationship with black Americans?
Well, I think the thing that I'm most eager to share with people is the word that Abraham Lincoln was murdered, not because he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, not because he supported the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery beyond the boundaries of the Emancipation Proclamation and throughout the country, but Abraham Lincoln was murdered because he called for black voting rights. And that was on April 11th, 1865. It was 2 days after Robert E. Lee surrendered. And Lincoln had privately recommended that black voting rights be included in the Constitution of Louisiana. But now he was making a public statement and the country was paying attention because the war was virtually over. So this was a very important speech Lincoln was giving. And the public expected a victory lap speech, congratulations to the Army and congratulations to the Navy. And instead, Lincoln gave a very sober, thoughtful analysis of Reconstruction. How should the states that have been in rebellion be politically rehabilitated? And one of the things that he is suggesting is that they at least allow black people who served in the armed forces and the black people who were very intelligent, as he put it, which meant literate, as far as we can tell. And among the audience that day at the White House, he was speaking from the White House to a huge crowd. In that audience that day was Frederick Douglass. And Douglass said later that year, he said, many of my abolitionist friends and myself included were a little disappointed in that speech because of the limited scope of Lincoln's proposal. Only the veterans of the Army and Navy and only the literate. So we were disappointed, but we shouldn't have been disappointed, but because we should have realized that Abraham Lincoln learned his statesmanship in the school of rail splitting. And to split a rail, you take a wedge and you insert the thin edge of the wedge. And having done that, you then take a large hammer, a maul, and you drive home the thick edge of the wedge. And what we should have realized that day was Abraham Lincoln was entering the thin edge of the wedge. And having done that, you could count on him to drive home the thick edge of the wedge, because that's the way he had dealt with slavery. So we underestimated the importance of that speech. But there was a young man in the audience named John Wilkes Booth who didn't underestimate the importance of that speech. And he turned to his companions as soon as he heard Lincoln suggest that black people be allowed to vote, at least a limited portion of the black population. And he said to his companions, that means N-word citizenship. By God, I'm going to run him through. That is the last speech he'll ever give. And 3 days later, Abraham Lincoln was murdered. Again, not because of the Emancipation Proclamation, not because of the 13th Amendment, but because of that speech in which he urged blacks to become citizens by having voting rights. And so I think it's therefore appropriate for us in the 21st century to regard Lincoln as a martyr to black citizenship rights, black civil rights, as much as Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and all those other people who were murdered back in the last century in the civil rights revolution of the 1960s and 70s.
I pull up notes on the speech and tell me if these are the topics he's touching on, where he's discussing his plans of reconstruction for the entire nation, based on one that had already been adopted in Louisiana. And he says, some 12,000 voters in the heretofore slave state of Louisiana have sworn allegiance to the Union, assumed to be the rightful political power of the state, held elections, organized a state government, adopted a free state constitution, given the benefit of public schools equally to black and white, and empowering the legislature to confer the elective franchise upon the colored man. So this is what he's talking about here?
Right, exactly. And he had written to the governor of Louisiana. Louisiana was undergoing Reconstruction, and Lincoln regarded that as the bellwether, that was the model for other states, the 10 other Confederate states. And there was an unusual situation in New Orleans. You had a large number of educated, tax-paying, literate blacks, and they had petitioned him back in March of 64. And he had spoken to the two gentlemen who brought this petition, signed by 1,000 men in New Orleans, calling for black voting rights. And Lincoln told them that he was very sympathetic, but that voting rights were really the function of states. Under our Constitution, states made the rules about who could vote in national elections, but he was very sympathetic. So then he writes to the governor in private a few days later, saying, now you're about to have a constitutional convention to replace the old pro-slavery Constitution. And I suggest that you include in that new Constitution a provision for black people to vote, at least the veterans of the armed forces and the very intelligent. Now, that was private. And so then the Constitutional Convention was held. The governor then takes that letter and shows it to the various members of the Constitutional Convention, the delegates. And when the Constitutional Convention first met, one of the initial steps they took was to pass a resolution saying, the state legislature of Louisiana shall never be allowed to enfranchise black people. And thanks to the effort of Lincoln's letter and the efforts of the governor and the military authorities and the like, they moved to a much different stance, which was if the legislature sees fit, it may do that. Now, that may seem to us in the 21st century like pretty small potatoes, but in 1864-60 in Louisiana, a convention of a bunch of white folks, that was a big step forward. And it really paved the way for what became black voting rights in Louisiana 4 years later.
Well, I've seen interesting pictures of Lincoln emerge. Some are starkly different when it comes to his perception of racial relations, depending on which comments of his over time are taken together, sometimes cherry-picked, and then the compositive image of what the researcher wants to appear comes forth. So I'd love to look at his views over time. Tell me about Lincoln's understanding of race as a young man, exposure to Southern slavery. And I understand he was influenced by the book by James Riley called An Authentic Narrative of the Loss of the American Brig Commerce, wrecked on the western coast of Africa in the month of August 1815, in which an American crew shipwrecks, they're enslaved on North Africa. And it gave the Americans a chance to look through the looking glass and see slavery with completely different eyes. So what were Lincoln's views as a young man?
Well, we don't know for sure how much of an effect that particular book had on Lincoln, but we do know that when Lincoln becomes a leader of the anti-slavery movement in Illinois, and indeed in the North, one of the themes he emphasizes is that many pro-slavery advocates in the South are saying that slavery is a good system no matter what race is involved, that it replaces free labor, that free labor is much less efficient, much less productive than slave labor. And whites could be slaves just as well as blacks. And I think one of the things that made Lincoln particularly sensitive to that issue was the fact that he had read the Riley book that you mentioned. But if I may back up just a step and say, apropos of your introductory phrasing of this question, but about cherry picking this statement and that statement and the other statement, the focus of my book is not on statements and letters and speeches and proclamations and the like. You've often heard it said that actions speak louder than words. And I think that's true, of course. But I have a variation on that I'm working with in this book, which is interactions speak louder than words. How did Lincoln interact with Black people? And surprisingly, that subject has been studied almost not at all. And so I've done a ton of research into the relations that Lincoln had with Black people in Springfield and in Washington. And not just people who come to the White House, although that's an important group, but when he goes to visit the Army, for example, or he goes to visit hospitals in Washington, how does he interact with Black people? And it's a very striking story. Almost every Black person says that Lincoln was remarkably free of prejudice, that he treated them with respect and cordiality. He took their requests seriously. He did whatever he could to accommodate them. And that this long series of interactions, I think, speaks louder than words, that Lincoln was an instinctive racial egalitarian, and that this manifested itself in these interactions, but also in the way he spoke about Black people. Now, it's said that he was a racist. Well, this book also has an appendix, a discussion of the evidence that people adduce when they claim that Lincoln was a racist. And they frequently cite the 1858 campaign against Stephen A. Douglas. And they also claim that Lincoln was a colonizationist from way back. Strikingly, during the 1858 campaign, there wasn't a word about colonization. And that Lincoln is sometimes called an enthusiast for colonization from way back. But in fact, if you look at Lincoln in the 1830s, 40s, and into the early 1850s, he doesn't join any of the colonization societies. There are three of them that are founded in central Illinois. He doesn't join any of them. And he does join the Illinois Colonization Society in the 1850s. And he actually gives a speech to that group, which has only recently been discovered. That is to say, a summary of the speech. And then he's very lukewarm. He said, well, colonization is not such a bad idea. Some people think it's serious, and it certainly deserves some attention. But he was very lukewarm about it. That is in the 1850s. And then, as I say, it doesn't show up in his debates with Stephen A. Douglas. Colonization is simply not mentioned. So about the 1858 debates, the central issue in those debates was this: are Black people included in the Declaration of Independence's stipulation that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among them liberty and the pursuit of happiness? And Lincoln insisted that Black people are included in that category of all men. And it's not some men, it's not white men, it's not European men, it's all men in the Declaration of Independence. And Douglas saying, oh, well, that's nonsense. The framers of the Constitution and the off-signers of the Declaration of Independence thought in terms of Europeans and white men, and not Indians and not Fiji Islanders and not coolies and not Black people. And Lincoln said, no, no, no. There's no evidence for that. There's no evidence that Black people were in the minds of the signers of the Declaration of Independence or the authors of the Constitution that they felt that way. And Douglas kept saying, but Lincoln, if you think that all men are created equal, you must believe that Black people should be voters and jurors and allowed to intermarry with whites and office holders. And Lincoln said, no, those are outlawed in Illinois, and I do not oppose them. And people jump on that and say, well, here, my goodness, Lincoln is supporting these laws that prohibit Blacks from voting and serving on jurors and holding office and intermarrying with whites. But that wasn't necessary lip service that you had to pay to the racism that pervaded Illinois. Illinois was, without much competition, the most negrophobic state in the Union. And if you aspired to win a statewide election in Illinois, you had to pay some lip service to that. And Lincoln does that on two occasions, but that's formulaic. And that's only because it was necessary for him to make that kind of concession to the prevailing racial views of the voters if he wanted to be able to beat Stephen A. Douglas. And beating Stephen A. Douglas in Lincoln's mind wasn't just to gratify his own personal ambition to be a senator, although he certainly wanted to be one. He thought that Stephen A. Douglas was the most dangerous person in the country when it came to bolstering slavery, because his argument was that people shouldn't take the slavery issue as a moral issue. They shouldn't get upset about it. That's a local issue. If the people out in the Western territories who move out there, if the white people who move out there want slavery, they should have it. If they don't want slavery, they should be able to abolish it. And Lincoln said, no, 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 no. That's leaving out the moral dimension. Slavery is wrong. It's a vast moral, political, and social evil. It must not be allowed to spread. And at the very beginning of that campaign in 1858, Lincoln says, apropos of Douglas's arguments, let's stop all this quibbling about this race and that race being in superior and the other inferior and the other must be held, placed in an inferior position. Let's stop all this quibbling and unite once again as a people, declaring with a good old Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. Well, that's at the beginning of the campaign. Douglas hammers him and hammers him and hammers him and hammers him about that, saying you must believe blacks should have civil rights and voting rights and all that. And Lincoln said, no, that issue isn't before us. The issue before us in Illinois is slavery right or slavery wrong. If you think slavery wrong is wrong, vote for us. If you don't, vote for them. But let's not muddy the waters with these side issues which are not before us today.
Right. And then other quotes that Lincoln writes, and I think it's in a letter to Joshua Speed where he says, as a nation, we begin by declaring that all men are created equal. We now practically read that all men are created equal except Negroes. When the know-nothings get control, it will read all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. When it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty, to Russia, for instance, where despotism can be taken pure and without the base alloy of hypocrisy. And I think that comes before the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Is that right?
1855, right. Joshua Speed writes to him and says, you were a Whig from the time of the 1830s when you first entered politics and up until now, but the Whig Party is kaput. Now where are you? He says, well, I used to be a Whig. They say the Whig Party is dead and it's not clear just where I stand now, but I do know that I'm not a know-nothing. I hate the idea, as you so eloquently summarized there or quoted Lincoln's statement. So that, and there he's talking to his best friend. And so he's not paying lip service to the dominant racist attitude of the average voter in Illinois. He's really telling what's on his heart, that he just hates the idea of this second-class citizenship for foreigners and Catholics and that the know-nothing stood for.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Well, I'm interested for the theme that you go into in your book of his actual interactions with Black Americans instead of statements here or there that are fairly well known in the Lincoln story. What did you find? I suppose we could start from some of the earliest accounts that you found. And what was the sourcing like for that? Or was it news accounts of him? Was it private accounts that he wrote or private accounts that others wrote? How did you find this? And what were some of his earliest interactions?
One of the earliest is fascinating. This is in 1836, apparently. That Lincoln was a young lawyer. He had just been admitted to the bar in Illinois, and he was also an Illinois state legislator. And so he was attending the Illinois state legislature's regular sessions in 1836, and he stayed at a boarding house in Vandalia, which was then the capital of Illinois. And a woman who worked at that boarding house later died in the 1890s, and her obituary said that as a young woman, she was indentured as a kind of quasi-slave, wasn't scheduled to be free until she was 18, but that Lincoln intervened to help get her out of her indentures before she reached the age of 18. Well, I was quite startled. This was called to my attention by a good friend. And so I checked with people in Vandalia who'd been looking into the court records and the like, and asked if they had any indication that this was the case. Were there any free papers? And I did some research in the court papers of Fayette County, where Vandalia is located. And they're very spotty for the 1830s. The record keeping and this preservation of records was pretty uncertain in those days. And I didn't find a document saying that this woman had been freed and that Lincoln had some role in it. But we do know that during that session of the legislature in late 1836, the Supreme Court of Illinois was also meeting. And the Supreme Court handed down a finding in a case dealing with indentured servitude. And the court ruling was this, that people whose indentures preceded 1818, that is the year when Illinois became a state, were still held to their indentures. Those were legally enforceable. But any children born to those people after 1818 were not held to indentures, even if they had entered into them, but they were no longer bound by them. Now, we don't know for sure that Lincoln, who would be certainly aware of what the Supreme Court was doing, he was a lawyer and a legislator, so it seems entirely possible that he then went to this woman and said, here's what you need to do to assert your rights and get out of your indentures, and you can be free before you were 18. And then she would have been about 14 then. So it looks as though he's the first person he liberated was somebody in 1836, at the very beginning of his political career and his legal career, or was at the early stage of his political career and the very beginning of his legal career. And we do know shortly thereafter, he was involved in a case where a Black woman had been sold into slavery in Illinois. And he made an argument, it's a slightly complicated case, but it boils down to this, that slavery was illegal in Illinois and that she was free. And as I say, it's a little complicated, but this is usually cited as the first time that Lincoln really got involved with a Black person, even indirectly, to be sure. But this earlier case in 1836 in Vandalia was called to my attention by a good friend, and I poked around, and it seems to be one of the first cases. So that all goes back to an obituary of this woman, and everything in the obituary checks out factually about who she was and when she got married and who her husband was and what her children's names were and all that. And the only thing that we can't establish beyond peradventure is that one statement about Lincoln. But it seems to fit, given the case that soon followed, called the case of Nancy, and then his later anti-slavery statements and actions. And in 1837, the year following year, Lincoln is in the Illinois State Legislature, and the legislature is urged by legislatures in the South to condemn abolitionism, that the abolitionists are a bunch of boat rockers and they're going to destroy the Union. And the state of Illinois legislature overwhelmingly votes to condemn the abolitionist movement. By the total vote of the House and the Senate together was 7 members out of 100. So it was 93-7 voted, yes, we're going to condemn the abolitionist movement. So 7 guys really had the nerve to stick their neck out. One of them was Lincoln. Lincoln and one other legislator goes further, and they together issue a statement that was published in the Journal of the Illinois State Legislature saying slavery is based on injustice and bad policy. And that was Lincoln wrote that. He only got one other legislator to sign it. And that guy was from Vermont, and he wasn't even running for reelection because he was going to be a judge. So Lincoln really sticks his neck out. And he's in central Illinois, which was a hotbed of Kentuckians who were not sympathetic to the anti-slavery movement. So Lincoln showed his bona fides as someone who was appalled by slavery early on in an official act where he's sticking his neck out. So his action as a legislator, and then it sounds like his action in 1837 and also in 1836 are among the first formal indications we have. So those are some of the sources. But then later, the main source is Black people then telling journalists or writing reminiscences where they talk about Lincoln and how cordial he was and how open-minded he was.
Right. And before getting into these, something I'm wondering is, with Lincoln's interactions with Black Americans, how far out of the mainstream would his conduct have been? Because I'm thinking the abolitionist movement itself, gathering steam in the 18th century, it was much more of an elite movement or somewhat of a dissident movement if you were a Quaker or an Anabaptist, and still a bit of a dissident thing in the 19th century. You could be a Northerner who's an abolitionist and maybe work with other Black Americans, let's say an abolitionist press. But how far out of the mainstream would you describe Lincoln? Would he be like, let's say, someone in the 1950s America who was in an interracial marriage when there would still be miscegenation laws in Jim Crow states? Would he be that far out, or how far would you characterize him?
Well, when we try to understand Lincoln's attitude toward race and compare him to 19th century norms, we have to remember that Lincoln was an office seeker in Illinois. And Illinois, as I mentioned earlier, was perhaps arguably the most Negrophobic state in the North because it was the first state that forbade Black people to move in. A lot of other states forbade them to vote and hold office and all that. But Illinois became the, in 1848, passes a constitution authorizing the legislature to forbid Black people even settle in the state. Indiana follows suit and Oregon follows suit, but Illinois was a real trailblazer. And so when we try to understand Lincoln's attitude toward slavery and also his attitude toward Black civil rights, we have to understand that in Illinois, you could not run as an opponent of both of those evils, that is slavery and second-class citizenship. Now, you could do that in Vermont or New Hampshire or Massachusetts and New England, where there are very few Blacks. I mean, 7% of the northern free Black population lived in New England. 93% lived in states where they couldn't vote and have civil rights. So Lincoln is put in a position like this. There are two evils, slavery and second-class citizenship. There are 4 million people in slavery. In the North, there may be 250,000 Blacks who can't vote and hold office and so forth. So clearly the slavery is the greater evil. They're both evil, but slavery is a greater evil. And you can't in Illinois campaign against them both if you want to have any chance of success. And it was important to be successful because Douglas was such a dangerous character. He was going to convince the American public that slavery was not a moral issue. You shouldn't care about the morality of slavery. It's a local option question about whether you should have beer on Sunday or something of that sort of thing. So Lincoln then focuses on slavery and the evil of slavery and doesn't want to have the issue muddied, to have the political waters roiled by this question of civil rights. That's for another time and another place. So Lincoln's views on slavery compared to other people in the Midwest, even anti-slavery, very strong anti-slavery spokespeople. And I compare them at some length in my appendix, that Lincoln's statements about race are much milder than some of the most radical abolitionists. Now, there were people like Charles Sumner, from Senator from Massachusetts, and Thaddeus Stevens, a representative from Pennsylvania, who were really modern by 21st century standards, super progressive. But Lincoln compared to Midwestern office seekers who were anti-slavery was among the vanguard.
That's an interesting way to look at it. And I want to come back to that to the end on assessing Lincoln, that one could make the argument that he's a consequentialist and is looking at the end. And if he has to adopt views that maybe don't represent his deepest sentiment, he's looking at the long game. But beyond speeches, returning to the main theme of your book are his interactions. And I'd like to look at some of the most noted abolitionists, Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth. What did they say in their interactions with him?
Well, Frederick Douglass met with Lincoln on three occasions, and Lincoln invited him to a social event to come to the summer White House and have tea with him. And Douglass had to turn that down because he had a speaking engagement at that time. But on the three occasions when they did meet, Douglass was profoundly gratified, as he says in letters written at the time, in reminiscences written later, in his autobiography, that he was struck by Lincoln's absence of prejudice, that he was one of the very few white men that he could speak to who didn't make himself conscious about his race, that he referred to him again and again as Mr. Douglass and treated him with respect and dignity and courtesy and took his arguments seriously and met them. So that's Douglass's first meeting in 1863. And he calls in the White House with a senator. And so the reason he was able to get in is because he was being escorted by a senator. In 1864, almost exactly 12 months later, he shows up at the White House, but he's invited by the president. Doesn't have to be escorted by a senator. So Lincoln is inviting Frederick Douglass to confer with him on public affairs. And it's a very dramatic meeting. And Lincoln was worried at that time that he was not going to be reelected. And he had good reason to be worried because the Northern public opinion had turned sour on the president because of the failure of the military campaigns that had begun in the spring to achieve notable success. And by late August, people were then there were huge casualties incurred in the spring and the summer and not much progress. So Lincoln says to Douglass, look, I'm afraid I'm not going to be reelected. And one of the things that this means is that whoever the Democrats put forward, and they hadn't chosen McClellan yet as their candidate, whoever is inaugurated to replace me on March 4th, 1865, isn't going to make slavery, the abolition of slavery, a priority. And there'll be a settlement, and all the slaves that are still outside of Union lines will remain in slavery. The only slaves will be free are those who are within Union lines. So between now, late August, and next March, I want all the slaves to come into our lines, to get them all under the tent of freedom. And Douglass says, well, you know, the slave owners are worked pretty hard to keep that news about emancipation from the slaves. And Lincoln says, well, I want you to organize an effort to send out scouts and penetrate into Confederate lines and go to the slaves and tell them, look, run away, get to Union lines. If you don't, you're going to stay in slavery. So Douglass goes off and spends a few days, several days, proposing a plan, which he then submits to Lincoln. But in the meantime, all of a sudden, the military tide turned. Sherman captured Atlanta. Sheridan won victories in the Shenandoah Valley. Farragut takes Mobile Bay. So all of a sudden, Lincoln's reelection is assured. And so that effort that Lincoln proposed, which was a little bit like what John Brown did. John Brown was going to send people out and encourage the slaves to run away and come to freedom in the mountains and then start a rebellion. So that was the remarkable episode. And then there's a famous episode when Douglass comes to the White House after Lincoln's second inaugural, and he's denied admission. And Lincoln hears about this and immediately orders the guards to let Douglass in. Then he greets him, and there's a long line of visitors waiting to shake his hand. And he sees Douglass come in, and he says, hey, Douglass, there's Douglass, my friend Douglass. There's no man whose opinion I value more, and I'm more eager to hear. Douglass, come here. And then Douglass says, well, Mr. President, you had all these people in line. I don't want to jump the line. And, no, the president. No, there's no man whose opinion I'm more eager to hear than you. So Douglass says, Mr. President, it was a sacred effort. And then Douglass time and again later says that Lincoln treated him with the utmost respect, didn't always agree with him, but you could sense that he was a racial egalitarian, that he hated slavery deeply and profoundly. Sojourner Truth comes and visits, and she then writes shortly thereafter that she was treated with the utmost respect by that great and good man. Had never been treated with more kindness and consideration than she was by that great and good man. So those are two examples of people, but there are lots of other people who are less famous who come to the White House and who have similar, Black people who have similar responses to their meetings with Lincoln. And you get that in newspaper recounts and in memoirs.
Who are these people that he's interacting with, and what do these accounts and memoirs note about these interactions?
Well, in Springfield, where Lincoln lived in a racially mixed community, just half a block down the street. He lived on 8th Street and at the corner of Jackson. And you go half a block past Jackson down 8th Street, going south, and Jameson Jenkins there. He's a delivery man, a carter, as they were called in those days. And he was actually a conductor on the Underground Railroad. So this is one of Lincoln's neighbors that he sees regularly. Now, unfortunately, we don't have any reminiscences from Jameson Jenkins, but the fact that he was a neighbor and was known as an activist on the Underground Railroad indicated to Lincoln, here's some Black people who are not just subservient, not just docile and accepting of second-class citizenship and willing to go along with slavery. These are people who really had some moxie, had some nerve and willing to stand up for the rights of their race. But then there's servants in the Lincoln home who were interviewed and had very positive things to say about Lincoln. But the most dramatic piece of evidence is a letter that he received from his barber, who was clearly a friend, not just an acquaintance or a client in a business sense, for whom he did some legal work. But when Lincoln's son dies, Willie, during the Civil War, 1862, this barber, William Florville, or Florville, the spelling varies, writes to him a long letter, and it's very warm and very friendly in tone, expresses profound sorrow for the death of Willie, describes him as an unusually sensitive boy and with much promise. Then he talks about how Lincoln's house is being well cared for by the people to whom it's been sublet, how the family dog is being well taken care of, and talks about his own family and what they're up to and what he's been up to. So it's a real friendly letter. It's not just a pro forma letter from a casual acquaintance, but clearly somebody who felt a bond of affection and connection with Lincoln. So that's Springfield. And then during the presidency, people would often come in to recommend certain policies or to ask that, for example, Frederick Douglass comes in and says, it's outrageous that Black people are being paid less than white people to serve in the army. And Lincoln said, well, I agree with you. This is unfortunate and we're going to take care of it. But in order to get that bill through, given the climate that existed in Congress, we had to make this concession, unfair though it is. And lo and behold, that pay differential was taken care of almost 100%. And then the example I said it earlier of the two gentlemen from Louisiana coming in with a petition of 1,000 people, Lincoln really acts on that. He's not just saying, well you've got a good case. He actually then writes to the governor of Louisiana and says, you know, you really ought to get the Constitutional Convention to enfranchise blacks, at least those who served in the army and those who are very intelligent. So Lincoln wouldn't just be cordial and then refer them somebody who had a petition to the War Department or the Navy Department or the Treasury Department or the like. Then he would also try to get black people jobs. He came from Springfield, Lincoln did, with a black servant who had worked in the Lincoln home for about a year, and who was a manservant, body servant, we would say. And he put him on the payroll at the White House. But there was a rebellion among the black people, the African-Americans on the staff, because this gentleman, William H. Johnson, who came with Lincoln from Springfield to Washington, had a very dark complexion. And the African-Americans who worked at the White House had very light complexions. And they wouldn't put up with having a dark African-American with dark skin on the staff. And within 3 days, Lincoln has to say, well, he tries to get the Secretary of the Navy to find a place for him and finally gets the Secretary of the Treasury to find a place for him. And then when this gentleman goes with Lincoln to Gettysburg in November of 1863, they both come back and they have contracted smallpox. Lincoln had a mild case. William H. Johnson had a severe case and he dies of smallpox. And then Lincoln pays for his funeral, pays for his coffin. He had guaranteed the loan that Johnson had taken out to purchase a house. And so he said to the bank, I'll pay that off. And the banker said, no, that's not necessary. And Lincoln said, no, I insist. I promised that if he couldn't pay, I'd pay. And while William H. Johnson was sick in the hospital, he couldn't sign his pay vouchers and wasn't getting paid. So Lincoln laboriously tracked down the necessary paperwork and was filling it all out and was then interviewed by a journalist. So his interaction with William H. Johnson, I think, is a striking example of Lincoln's racial egalitarian instincts. So those are some of the examples, aside from the more famous ones that Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass constitute.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. One episode that takes up a chapter in your book has to do with a centerpiece of the 1619 Project, the New York Times article series talking about the racism being enmeshed with American history from the origins going back to the first slave ship in 1519, the Jamestown colony, up to the American Revolution, up to the conduct of Lincoln himself. And with Lincoln, the episode is in August 1862, where he invites a committee of black men to the White House, and he's trying to recruit volunteers for colonization outside of the United States, which you mentioned earlier. This would be probably a reservation Congress would purchase in Central America. So he's asking, and the quote in the 1619 Project is that he believed that free black people were a troublesome presence incompatible with a democracy intended only for white people. So there's a tremendous amount of reading into the story, but can you describe the story and then also the colonization too, and this whole argument about abolition, because segregationists pro-slavery thought that the colonization was a Trojan horse for abolition. Others thought that colonization was only a half measure to not integrate black people into American society. So what was the issue of colonization? And then can you describe this particular episode and what you make of it?
Yes. I have a long chapter on this episode where Lincoln invites five leaders of the black community to come to the White House. And this is the first time blacks had been summoned to the White House to confer on public affairs. Frederick Douglass comes, but that's the first episode, as I mentioned earlier, 63. So this is the first time an American president has invited somebody to come to the White House to talk about public affairs. And Lincoln explains, look, Congress has appropriated what in modern dollars would be millions and millions of dollars for colonization. And I'm now faced, and it's at my discretion. I can spend it any way I want to. Now, I would like to deal with this issue and get your feedback. And he says in the course of this long discussion, and by the way, one of the most striking features of this discussion with these five black leaders of the Washington community is that there was a shorthand reporter present at this meeting. At no other meeting of Lincoln's is there a shorthand reporter available, well, during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, but Lincoln didn't invite anybody into the president's office to take down verbatim what he was saying to his visitors. And this, I think, illustrates what was really going on that day in August of 1862, that Lincoln was trying to grease the skids for emancipation, that he had announced the previous month in July of 1862, announced to his cabinet that he was going to issue an Emancipation Proclamation. He wasn't asking for their opinion about it. He was informing them that it was going to happen. And they said, some of them said, we've just suffered a humiliating defeat in our campaign against Richmond. If we issue an Emancipation Proclamation on the heels of that defeat, it will look like a desperation measure and it will look insincere. So let's wait until we have a military victory. And Lincoln says, I should have thought of that. You're right. So Lincoln has the Emancipation Proclamation all written. It's ready to go. He's waiting for a military victory. Now, he knows that there's going to be a significant white backlash against the Emancipation Proclamation, particularly in the four loyal slave states, Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware, and Missouri, and also in the lower North, that is to say, Southern Ohio, Southern Indiana, Southern Ohio, Southern Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and the like. The lower North, conservatives are really going to be upset. So what can he do to minimize that white backlash? Well, he's been told by political advisors, by senators from those states, and representatives from those states, newspaper editors from those states, correspondents from those states, our people, that is the whites in the border slave states and the lower North, are only going to accept emancipation if it is coupled with colonization. Because they are fearful, those whites, that as soon as the Emancipation Proclamation goes into effect, the blacks are going to come flooding into the North, and they don't want that. And so if they'll go along with emancipation, but only if you seem to be serious about colonization. And colonization, of course, wasn't his idea. That dated back to 1816 with the Colonization Society. And there were a lot of black colonizationists, too, let's remember. So Lincoln's primary motive in inviting those gentlemen to the White House was to get that story into the press where he would urge these gentlemen to act as pioneers in establishing a colony in what today is known as Panama. And he said, you all can be role models. You can model this behavior because if you do it, then a lot of you're influential and a lot of people will follow. And so this will allow this to actually occur. So to some extent, Lincoln was being a little disingenuous that he was using these gentlemen as a prop, in effect, for PR purposes to convince Northern whites that emancipation would be coupled with colonization. But there's a second consideration. Namely, Lincoln believed that some black people were so pessimistic about their future in the United States that they would never get treated like first-class citizens. And that those people, for understandable reasons, were deeply pessimistic. And the government owed it to those people to provide some refuge, some sanctuary abroad where they would be treated like first-class citizens. And so Lincoln's motivation in 1862, when it came to colonization, was twofold. One, to help grease the skids for emancipation, and two, to allow black people who are racial pessimists a refuge. Now, and the language he uses is regarded as patronizing and the like, but he says, your people are suffering the greatest wrong that any people have ever suffered anywhere, anytime. Well, pretty strong language. And even when you're not enslaved, you're treated like second-class citizens. Go where you will in the North. The ban is still upon you. You're treated like second-class citizens. And I don't propose to discuss this. It's something that you don't like at all, and I don't like at all. And what can we do about it? He gives them a lecture, in effect. He doesn't really invite a true conversation, but he says, I'd like you to think over this proposal about Panama and let me know your feelings. Well, Frederick Douglass then goes ballistic, and he denounces Lincoln in the most vitriolic terms, as though he's a classic example of Negro hatred, and this shows his true colors and the like. And yet, Frederick Douglass had three adult sons, and two of them volunteered to go to Panama. So you think, well, if Lincoln was a hopeless racist, what are Frederick Douglass's sons signing up for this for? And according to the senator who was in charge of facilitating this project, which fizzled, 14,000 blacks applied to go. And there were a lot of black leaders and opinion leaders denounced Lincoln. But then there are important black leaders who supported it and who even said, let's not get all upset. Let us black people not get all upset that Lincoln is not really this hard of heart a colonizationist, that he really does have to help grease the skids for emancipation. And there's Henry Highland Garnett says this and others of that prominence. And that's one of the things that I discovered that I've never seen quoted before. Henry McNeil Turner, Henry Highland Garnett, these guys saying, Lincoln has to protect his flank because he knows that there's going to be some resistance to emancipation. So this isn't just historians making this up as an excuse in retrospect. This is what people were saying, Black people were saying at the time. And these Black people seem to have talked to Lincoln about that, although the evidence for that is not entirely solid, but it certainly seems that way. So that whole thing fizzled. And so then Lincoln does approve rather hastily toward the end of 1862 and into 63, a plan to have Black people who want to go to a safe haven to go to Haiti. And that turns out to be a disaster. 450 Blacks put on a ship. They go to Haiti. They suffer terribly. They're mistreated by the Haitians. The people who are in charge of the project mistreat them badly. They have terrible problems with disease and insects and all kinds of problems. And Lincoln then summons them back. He sends a ship down and says, bring these people back. Now, why did he support that one? He didn't make a big to-do about it. It was even after the Emancipation Proclamation was announced that this took place. So it wasn't an attempt to persuade white people in the North that he was really sincere about colonization. I think the reason he supported that Haitian colonization project is because Black people who had come to Union lines were suffering terribly in what were known as contraband camps, refugee camps, disease-ridden, poor nutrition, poor sanitation. And these camps were, there was a lot of suffering, and people were coming to Lincoln and saying, you've got to do something about this. And this was particularly true in Virginia, around the Norfolk area. And those people who went to Haiti were from that area. And so I think that was Lincoln's humanitarian concern for the suffering of those people in those contraband camps that led him to endorse this Haitian plan without properly vetting it and making sure that it was going to be carried out properly, and was scandalized when the stories came back about how these poor people were being mistreated and immediately dispatched a ship to bring them back. So there was a humanitarian concern, and the notion that Lincoln wanted to deport Black people and that was the only way to solve the race problem is a gross misunderstanding of that meeting and indeed of Lincoln's colonization plans in general.
It makes sense that in trying to address the most challenging domestic issue of the age, there would be lots of solutions that would be given out, particularly solutions that would have a constituency that would support it, and not everything would work effectively. If we think today, how are we trying to solve issues like healthcare, where there are lots of competing issues being put forward, depending on if there's a natural constituency or not, and economic uncertainties and the like. And this is a far thornier and more challenging issue because there's a whole human rights dimension that doesn't even enter in the contemporary discussion. I think coming to a head, there's a lot of contemporary relevance and people talking about how we assess Lincoln's record. And there's always been a nasty element of presentism when we look at historical figures. There's the Whig school of history that saw everyone who was leading up to the present day in Britain at the time the school was developed as either heroes or villains based on what role they played in the story. And anyone who is part of a so-called historical dead end is not a praiseworthy figure. And more than any time, I think, well, presentism right now is very strong, particularly if we have any discussion about race issues, that if someone doesn't have a contemporary 21st century view on it in the past, then they're essentially a villain, which really disqualifies almost anyone that wasn't active in public life within the last 20 years or perhaps even sooner. So how do you, I suppose, to take the issue of Lincoln, how do you look at his legacy? And then the broader question of, I don't know, historical heroes or villains is, what do you look at is, how much positive effect do they produce? If they go from first base to third base, then they're much more praiseworthy than if they're born on third base and they manage to get to home base. So how do you look at this?
Well, a number of things should be said about that. But when we deal with historical figures, do we judge them by the standards of their time or our time? And a lot of the criticism of Lincoln and Jefferson, for example, are based on 21st century norms of what's progressive and enlightened as opposed to what's unprogressive and unenlightened. If we judge Lincoln by the standards of the 21st century, he was in some ways unenlightened. But if we judge him from the standards of his own time and place and political situation, he was, as Frederick Douglass says in one of his speeches, swift, determined, and zealous. And as I tell my students, I say, when it comes to passing judgment on historical figures and generations, let's think for a moment about how we might be regarded 100 years from now. Now, how many of you students are vegetarians? Turns out very few. And I say, okay, well, now to you carnivores, omnivores, let's say 100 years from now, 150 years from now, almost all educated Americans are vegetarians for humanitarian reasons and ecological reasons. Would it be fair for them to look back on you as moral lepers because you were meat eaters? And I don't mean to equate slavery with meat eating as an evil, but logically, the same general rules, I think, apply. So when we compare Lincoln to his times, and again, when consider his in the legislature, you know, 7 guys out of 100 vote to say, we're not going to condemn the abolitionists. And 2 then go so far as to say, slavery is based on injustice and bad policy. When he's in Congress in 1849, there's a lot of talk about abolishing the slave trade in Washington. Lincoln writes a bill to abolish slavery itself, not slave trading, but slavery itself, pretty far ahead of his time. And then when it came to sticking his neck out on black voting rights, it gets him killed. And people at the time were saying this. William Lloyd Garrison, gets the most influential abolitionist of all, says to another abolitionist who's condemning Lincoln in 1864 and the election campaign, saying, look, we have to understand that Lincoln isn't an editorial writer. Lincoln isn't a preacher. Lincoln isn't an anti-slavery agitator. He's an office holder. He has responsibilities. He can't do everything that he would like to do. He's constrained by political considerations and constitutional considerations. And when you take those into account, he's doing a terrific job. That's Garrison. And it turned out that Wendell Phillips, who was the firebrand, who kind of national scold, who was giving Lincoln a hard time, was very much on the kind of lunatic fringe at that point in 1864. Although by modern standards, by 21st century standards, Wendell Phillips has a kind of a very honored position, but he didn't have any responsibility to formulate policy and carry it out. And Garrison, I think, was much more sensible in pointing that out. And an awful lot of people, even on the abolitionist ranks, within those ranks, agreed with Garrison at that time.
Well, yeah, I agree with all that, that without bothering to look into the context of his times, then with Lincoln or with anyone else, I mean, it's essentially lazy. And you also lose the story of progress of what it takes to get to the point we are at now, that in many ways, it's not the natural state of affairs, but it's built on the incredible efforts of those who came before us. And as you know, at the beginning of this discussion, that for the reason for his assassination of granting full citizenship rights, that's what brought it about, not simply winning the Civil War. Well, I mean, there's a lot more to get into in this book, and for listeners who want to check it out, the name of the book is The Black Man's President, Abraham Lincoln, African Americans, and the Pursuit of Racial Equality. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at 3 levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.